Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
The gypsy woman told my mother before I was born, I got a boy child coming. He's gonna be a son of a gun. He's gonna make pretty women jump and shout. Then the world wanna know what this all about.
Now, what in the world is going on here? I said in my pre-intro that we're going to be talking with Ron Grossman about history and about classical antiquity. And here we are playing Muddy Waters, the great Chicago blues band. Why in the world am I doing that? I'll ask Ron Grossman.
Because life has a way of taking you down 17 paths at the same time.
Yep.
When I studied history at the University of Chicago, one of the great things about it, besides that library full of ancient wisdom, was proximity to Bronzeville and to the jazz and blues joints that were up and down 47th Street at the time. So Muddy Waters and Thucydides were my two muses.
And only recently for the paper, you wrote an article about Bronzeville, and you deal with the Rolling Stones and connecting them to Muddy Waters.
Yes, we do these, actually these history pieces on Sunday. Mm-hmm. So some way or other, I've cycled back to that which was I was trained to do, which is to write history. And it being Black History Month, we recounted the time that the Rolling Stones went out to the Checkerboard Lounge to sit in with Muddy Waters. And I wasn't there that evening. I think I was out of town teaching by that point. But it was a miraculous evening. And when and they did it because they took their name, the Rolling Stone, from a lyric of Muddy Waters.
In his number, Mannish Boy.
Yes, if I might recite the poetry.
I think you must.
I'm a man, I'm a natural-born lover's man, I'm a man, I'm a Rolling Stone. Mm-hmm. Whence the Rolling Stones. And when Mick Jagger went up on stage, he at one point he was singing a line about, I guess from something of his own, I was born lucky. And Muddy Waters looked over and said, I can see that, son.
Yeah.
I mean, here you have the English countryside coming back with a man who was raised on a plantation in the South and then came short.
Well, as an historian, you well know, and indeed you were very interested in some of the early writing that you did, in the class distinctions in the ancient world.
Indeed.
As well as in modern Chicago.
Yes. The plantation in the American South was called a latifundia in Roman times, and they were both the same thing, huge agricultural estates worked by unfree or semi-free laborers. Now, here is the miracle or the disaster of America. One time, my wife and I were cruising around the Mississippi Delta, and we saw among the tourist attractions that you could go to and visit, and I think even if you came up with the right amount of money, stay in the cabin where Muddy Waters was born.
Uh-huh.
But we couldn't do it because I called only to find that the cabin was out of town. We were there, but they had some kind of deal with one of these kind of franchised blues places. I think we have one in Chicago. And so they schlepped his cabin around the nation on a flatbed truck. I pose the question, is this a wonderful country?
Well, that's showbiz.
Yes, it is, indeed.
There were similar manifestations of showbiz probably in classical antiquity as well. One I certainly remember is that in Nero, a great, strange, and horrible Roman emperor, about fifth or sixth in line after the empire was founded.
Fourth
in line only. Do I remember the sequence? Augustus,
Tiberius. Caligula.
Also a
not a bad guy best, himself. Nero.
And then Nero.
Yeah.
And after Nero comes the more reasonable Claudius.
Yes.
But when Nero was reigning, he also thought himself a great rock star, or the equivalent. And he insisted on going to Greece for a festival where he would entertained them with his lyre and with his songs.
And he also went to the Olympics and had the thing fixed.
Yeah.
And even though the wheels fell off his chariot, the judges awarded him first place.
Yes. Now, we come to history and the discipline. People who are listening to us right now and who are regular listeners know that you've had a long association with this program. Not only did we used to do, we no longer do because our schedule has changed, so it's no longer required, but we used to do short pieces that we called the Grossman Gazette, in which we would talk about one of your particular recent stories and elaborate on it. Mm-hmm. Actually, you would come down in an afternoon. We would record 8 or 10 of them. Then we'd play them for the next year, one or two after a ball game.
And then the morning afterward, people will either say, I love what you said last night, or how could you say that? Yeah. And since I didn't know what was played, I'd have to sort of fake it for a while.
But now we don't do that anymore because they've changed the schedule concerning baseball so that we know when baseball will go. It will go to the end of the hour. If we're coming on at all, we'll come on at 11 rather than at 10 after a baseball game. The season will commence shortly, as you know. So,
how can you argue with America's sport?
You can't. And how can you argue with the managers of WGN? But you're a frequent guest on this program. Most recently, you were here for our Use and Abuse of the English Language program.
This is correct.
In fact, you have also a few times substituted for me as host of the program.
Yes, I have.
Do you remember which ones they were?
Well, the one I remember most was the authors of a book about Soviet Jews who relocated to Chicago. And this is my first time presiding in the green room. And they march in there, the two co-authors of the book and four people mm-hmm. that are interviewed for the book, who seem to have among them about 3 words of English. Now I realize it's going to be a long night. We come on, and I say, trying my best to do an impression of you, we have and how da 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 da. And I ask the author, how many former Soviet Jews have come to Chicago? And she responded, echoing down the ages, I don't know.
Yes.
Now I've got the historian without the data, and the data that doesn't speak English. I've got to stall. So every time the producer signals me that it's a commercial coming up, I let in whatever the guy or the lady bought the commercial, he got twice as much from me leading in. And afterwards, the producer said, how did you know to do it? And I said, that's simple survival skills.
Yeah. I heard it. I was at home recuperating from some dental work, yes. I think, and I heard it. I was bleeding for you. But I knew exactly what a horror you were facing, but you managed.
I thought when I go to the phones, the lovely wife, my children will call in, nothing. Now, even my mother the next day said, I got busy ironing.
Dead phones.
Yes.
That's terrible, too. But I went through all of this about your background in relation to the program because I want now to make very clear, let me make one thing perfectly clear, as Nixon used to say.
Yes.
That though you've been a great journalist of, how many years is it now at the Tribune?
About 30.
About 30 years. Yeah. But before that came some 20 years, was it? Or
about 25.
25 years mm-hmm. as a professor of history.
You got your
PhD at the University of Chicago. And then
right.
You went off to begin with, as I remember, to the University of Nebraska.
Yes, I
did.
In
Lincoln.
Yes.
And you wound up finally in an academic post at Lake Forest College.
Just north of the city here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Until they lured you down to the Tribune.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after some commercials, which are coming almost instantly, we're going to talk about history and your thoughts about history, some of the areas in history that particularly invest and involve you.
But first, we'll pause for a moment for a message from our sponsors.
Wonderfully said.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
So now down to the serious work.
Yes.
Namely, to talk about history and illuminate our generalizations about the nature of history with some references to particular historical episodes, historical periods, especially the ones that you've worked on as a historian. But first, would it be fair to say that we had historians before we knew what the discipline of history was? I think particularly of Herodotus, who's considered the first great Western historian.
Generally called the father of history.
But he didn't do it the way modern historians do at all. He was a gossip.
Yes, he was something between a gossip and an anthropologist, yeah. And he freely confesses to it. He traveled around the ancient Mediterranean, the eastern half of it, and he'll say, when I was in Egypt, I heard the following story. So at least there's a kind of footnote in there
yeah.
that says, and I leave it to future generations of graduate students to prove me right or wrong.
But he got interested in Egyptian burial procedures, and he does a whole chapter or two on that.
Indeed.
And this is interspersed in his, what is essentially a book concerned with the history of the Persian War.
Yes, but like a good professor, he can't resist backing up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He gets to a point and then he says, well, to understand this, this reminds me of the time, etc., etc.
Now, modern history, or historiography as they call it in the precincts of history departments, was much influenced by a German of the 19th century called Leopold von Ranke.
Yes.
Whose famous dictum, his order to all future historians, was that their task was, alles erzählen, wie es eigentlich gewesen war. Tell everything the way it really happened.
Right.
The way it really was.
Yes. Yes.
And is that possible?
It's not easy. And let me give you some personal experience. After years of writing about this and that, the newspaper has created a Sunday feature called Flashback,
mm-hmm.
where we take a chapter from Chicago history and write about it. And, you know, no matter how well-trained you are in a field, much of what you say in front of a class, you're repeating what you heard from someone else. There's no way you could give a record of it completely from the sources, unless maybe some periods of ancient history. But we conveniently forget about that in the classroom. We don't say, as Herodotus did, somebody said to me. We write the names on the board. We tell it as if this is the record carved in stone, but it's not. But since we've started doing these pieces, it means going back and pulling up the records from the newspaper of the people that were closest to it. And perhaps sober enough, reporters back a while were not exactly the most clean living of types, but they set it down.
Now they are.
No, they're not.
That's my point.
Yes. And so I have to come through that material, and sometimes it's quite surprising that what I thought I knew is not what those who were there at mm-hmm. the time recalled.
His successor, some 40 to 50 years later, Thucydides, is really in many ways the father of modern historical method. He insisted you had to go to sources, and he said you don't report anything as factual as having actually happened unless you can confirm it from at least one other source, preferably two others, namely triangulate, get at least three separate sources all confirming that such and such a battle was lost for this or that reason.
Let me pay the man a compliment. He did what I just said I now do.
Yeah.
He rummaged
That's what brought him to
Yes,
mind.
Of course. He says that, you know, as this war between Athens and Sparta was getting started, I realized this...
That's his war, the Peloponnesian War.
The Peloponnesian.
Rather than the Persian War.
Yes. I realized that this was a momentous event taking place, or series of events, and so I kept everything I could find out about it. That is returning to the sources.
Also, he says that, and he's doing it systematically because this book will be not merely an account for the moment, but a possession for all time.
Exactly.
That's the translation of his very words.
Exactly.
Meaning you can learn from the past something that will be useful in the future.
Which is a very essentially Western way of looking at things.
Yes, it is.
You know, if you look at Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they tell their story, their theology in time. This happened, and then that happened, and then God enjoined this, as opposed to what I'm told about Eastern religions, which is that they are more psychological. Mm-hmm. But we see things as before, now, and after. My mother dated everything from Rachel's betrothal or Jaime's bar mitzvah, and you can hear the echo in that. There is a date before or after which we can count.
In Thucydides, do you remember his triad. He raises the basic question, since he's writing about war, a war in which he was a major general officer, an admiral, until he was disgraced for having lost the battle and they kicked him out. But he raises the basic question.
You know, the minute you raise it, it brings to mind Josephus, the author of the great history of the Jews and their war against the Romans, again, lost something, was kicked out, and decided to write it down.
But Thucydides raises the question, what are the ultimate goads, the ultimate sources of war? Why do nations go to war? And he says essentially there are three motivations or three provocations. One is interest, that is, they want to gain things. Another is fear, that is, needing to preserve the state's security against possible depredations against the state. And the third is honor. Men seek honor. Meno theos tausumferon, I think, in the Greek.
More or less, yes.
Doesn't that impress you?
Yes, and the interesting thing is that if you look at modern historians, after every great war, like the First World War, called strangely the Great War, and World War II, then there's book after book that says, how did we get into it? What were the factors that went in? And what was the peculiar mix of it?
Well, that's the essential historical challenge, isn't it, for the real doing of historiography in modern time. Namely, you have to explain why, not merely tell what happened, but explain why it happened and how it happened.
Historians go back and forth on that. Myself, that's the reason I went into it, is to know why things happened. But some historians more or less despair of it, and they simply say, no, all we can do is say that it happened. To me, that makes it dull and uninteresting.
So here now, getting down to real history and getting back to an area in which you researched, in which you wrote, and one of the great historical questions, one of the major great historical works by Edmund Gibbon raises the question and is addressed to it, namely the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Why did Rome fall? It ruled the known world, the Mediterranean world at least, did it for 4 or 5 centuries.
More. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, actually, I was thinking of the empire, which begins with Augustus, whom we mentioned earlier. But of course, the republic preceding him was another 3 or 4 centuries in advance of the rise of the empire. But ultimately, Rome falls and is decadent. And the great question that Gibbon addresses is why and how did that happen? What's your answer?
You know these books, An Idiot's Guide to This.
Yeah.
Or I forget, there's a whole series of outline of this.
Sure.
And now you can even get them. They're sort of in a piece of plastic. And it's everything you need to know about on one page. Mr. Gibbon wrote a very long history in a wonderfully poetic language that you sometimes wake up after several pages and say, was Haber gesagt? What did he say? But then
whatever he said it beautifully.
Yes, he did. Yes, and not in Yiddish. The man spoke a wonderful English. But then he boiled it all down and said, "I have been tracing two factors: the triumph of barbarism and Christianity." Note for the radio audience: this is not necessarily the second part, my view, but that's
it was Gibbon's view.
It was Gibbon's view.
Christianity did Rome in, he says.
He saw it softened. Remember that Gibbon is writing in the age of the Enlightenment, where we're going for the rational principle and we're figuring out everything scientifically, and religion begins to seem like superstition or something like that.
Now, of course, Gibbon wasn't the first to ask the question, why do civilizations which once rose and commanded a large portion of the world and had great prosperity and so on, why do they ultimately fall? He's not the first to raise that question. An historian in whom you had a great interest raised the question way back in Roman times, namely Polybius.
Yes, and Polybius raised the question of why they rise, and St. Augustine and a pupil of his by the name of Roscius posed the question of why they fall. Polybius, who is as much a political scientist as a historian, as we would understand it, spotted what he thought was the key to Rome's success in that it had some aspects of an aristocratic society. those my mother would call the Allreitniks.
Mm-hmm.
It had some aspects of a democratic society. Great decisions could only be made by the commissia, the assemblies. And it had some aspects of, you wouldn't say royalty because that was a naughty word for the Romans, but some aspects of authoritarianism. It had the two consuls. And he posited the idea that other states had one or the other of those. But the three, it's like we say when they shoot a rocket into space, they had redundant systems. So where one part of the Constitution wasn't working, the other part would kick in, and they would have what we call checks and balances.
Yeah, and you have, in essence, officers and enlisted men.
Yes.
The plebeian class are the common folks, but they do have a veto over what the Senate made of aristocrats ultimately decides.
The name of our newspaper is Tribune, from the officer at Rome called the Tribune Plebis, literally he who calls out on behalf of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And he would walk around, and if he spotted anything going on, from some bureaucrat to the consuls going off to war, he could put his hand up and say, veto. Our word, veto.
Yes, exactly.
And it brought the thing to a halt. Mm. Now, Polybius described the beauty of it. But after a while, the ruling clique decided, and you had to be a plebeian to get elected to that office.
Mm-hmm.
This was not something that I don't want to pick up on contemporary politics, but wealthy candidates were out. But the wealthy aristocrats realized all they needed was to get a couple of plebeians in as veto, because eventually there were 10 of them. So you could veto the veto, and the thing would start again.
This gets rather intricate and quite fascinating. We're going to do more with it, but we must first take a pause. I think even back in Roman times, they honored enterprise.
Oh, very much.
That's what we do. Right after we first hear an update on the news from David Jennings.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything gonna be all right this morning. Oh, yeah.
I think I may fairly say this is the only radio program ever in history that combines Muddy Waters with Thucydides.
Yes, indeed.
But still, it's relevant to the work you've done on the history of Chicago blues in Bronzeville. And
it's also Chicago's gift to the world.
Yeah,
the blues were born in the American South.
Yeah.
And then with the great migration of African-Americans to Chicago, they brought it up here. They played it outdoors on Maxwell Street.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody said, you got to amplify that. And that's the blues. And it's Chicago's gift to the world. You know, blues mm-hmm. seems old-fashioned to many younger people.
Yeah.
But you go to Paris, and I have seen in the music stores there are kids 16, 17 years old going through those bins and saying, oh, here's the alternate takes on Howling Wolf so-and-so sessions.
Yeah.
And they know it. They know it.
Mannish Boy by Muddy Waters. We just heard the openings of it. That's where the Rolling Stones actually got their title.
Yes, that's right, because the refrain is, I'm a man, I'm a Rolling Stone, I'm a Rolling Stone.
But now let's roll the stone back to antiquity yet once again, or rather to the basic question of class divisions within ancient society. You know, an interesting contrast. We've been talking about the way in which they organized class divisions or class separations and distribution of power in Rome. In Greece, if we take, say, Plato's Republic as an idealization of what Greece could be or should be, essentially, he writes about the different classes, but he argues that all power ultimately must be in the hands of the Philosopher Kings.
Yes.
Who? What did he mean by the Philosopher Kings?
Those who wouldn't execute his teacher, Socrates, I suppose. It's interesting that Athens produced the philosophers, but most of them admired Sparta, which was the totalitarian society, mm-hmm. rather than the open and democratic one. Plato's Republic is divided by classes. And the top one is the one that makes the rules. They're called the guardians. And but it's interesting that in modern society, those who make the rules tend to have the geld, the money. But Plato thought that that would be a corruption. So they lead, to coin a phrase, a Spartan life. They live in barracks like the Spartan males did. They don't have many material goods to distract them, and they just think great thoughts and steer the ship of state.
Do we have models from the ancient world? We're taking some samplings from the ancient world, from Greece and Rome, for that matter. There are other periods in older history, in the older history of Europe, and there are the vast histories of totally other civilizations. What we know about Chinese civilization, what we know about Indian civilization, East Indian. Do we have any models that are workable for modernity, do you think?
When you said models, I was seeing a visual image. I've been out looking at old synagogues in Chicago for a story that will appear in tomorrow's Chicago Tribune.
Oh, nice.
And many of them, and if you think about many of our public buildings, have colonnades on them. They're, I think we call it Greek Revival.
Sure.
And it's the idea that that's where proportionality came. That, you know, the Mede Echein, the Greek motto, nothing in excess, the mm-hmm. perfect proportion in visual things, the perfect proportion.
The golden mean.
The golden mean in political things, and that's how it works. In contemporary life, I don't think it works any better than it did for the Greeks. Plato never got a chance to put it into effect. You know, he was summoned to Syracuse.
To give them a new constitution.
To give them a new constitution, and it didn't work.
That's what his business was. He was a constitutional consultant.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, yes. And which reminds me that when I was in graduate school, I had a buddy who was taking his degree in political science, and his first job was to go to a West African country, which had just got its independence, or was getting its independence, to write their constitution.
Incredible.
He went from graduate student to the father of somebody else's country. You know?
But that's the great the eternal issue, isn't it? It's basic in all history. It's basic, really, in all human preoccupation with societies and with political orders. How do you organize things so that it holds, so that it's stable, so that people are more or less fulfilled, so that the arts and the sciences or whatever flourish, so that there is respect to the aged and proper care for the young? How do you establish and maintain a good society? In fact, through all of history, nothing ever really lasts.
Yes, that's true. It doesn't last. But I do believe that things get better. Let's come back to Plato for a minute. He must have realized that problem because he hedged his bet philosophically. Besides talking about perfect states and social orders and all that, he said, oh, by the way, the world we think we see, it's not really the one. And that's why things seem to be transitory. Uh-huh. Metal rusts, wood decays, etc. But behind this imperfect world, there's a perfect world. And we may not be able to get to it in our body, but we can certainly get to it with our intellect and perceive its quality.
And that's the meaning of the Platonic ideal.
Exactly. And it comes over into Christianity as the split between the body which decays and the soul which is eternal.
And he handles that with a wonderful metaphor, the allegory of the cave.
Yes.
Explain that a bit.
Plato said, you know, if you can't quite figure out what I'm saying, listen, here's what it is. Imagine there's a cave and that there's human beings sitting in there in such a fashion that they have to look at the wall of the cave. And they're not only chained down, but their heads are, you know how they have on horses, blinkers? They can only see that. Behind them is a fire. and things move between the fire and them, casting shadows on the wall. So if you ask them, how many dimensions does the world have, they say two. You can see it's flat. Incidentally, there was a wonderful series in the Scientific America which spun that out about what would the world be like if it was a flat one.
It's called Flatland.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so Plato says, so things went along like that. And then one of the guys, somebody, like a prison break, they slipped him a file or something, and he cut the bounds off and he went outside and he saw the sunlight. And at first, you could imagine coming from darkness to light, he was absolutely blinded by it. But then as he began to blink, he saw, oh my goodness, there's a depth to things. And so he thought, well, I'm the greatest discoverer of all times. He rushes back in to tell the rest of the people that, and they said, come on, come on, look at it, it's flat.
Yeah.
Huh? That's his idea. We have to realize that behind the shadows, there is a more perfect world.
So it's his way of saying, we think we know reality, but the reality we know is limited in its perceptual source. And there's another reality, a truer and more ultimate reality, which is not capable of apprehension by us.
But we can get closer to it, and that comes to be the modern...
And that's the job of philosophy, he says.
Exactly, and that comes to be the modern idea of progress.
Yeah.
If you look at the Romans, the Greeks a little less, but the Romans are always kvetching, we're not the people that our ancestors were. In other words, they see human events sloping down, but that inheritance of trying to get to that better world is really picked up by Christianity. And it's then secularized, and that's our idea of we can be better than we were. And this comes down to it. In every Jewish, Gentile, and Muslim mother's injunction to the kid, stay in school, go to college, you'll make a better life for yourself.
So you're suggesting there's a kind of linearity in progress. Maybe not a totally rising line, but basically things do keep getting better.
Enough that we can believe in it.
Can you really? Just look at the 20th century, which somebody called that slum of a century.
Yes.
A century in which about 200 million civilian human beings were killed, not by accident, but as a policy of state. The Holocaust, with which you and I are so familiar, and which Jewish people tend to still think about in very, very anguished terms, killed 6 million.
Yes.
But those 6 million were only 6 million out of 200 million
right.
Destroyed by states as a matter of intention. Mao Zedong starved to death, knowing he was doing so, some 50 million people. It was a way of kind of cleaning the slate. Stalin did the very same. He gave the model to Mao earlier by starving to death as a matter of fully intended consequence, the Ukrainians, killing 5 or 6 million of them in the early 1930s. And so it went on and on through all that century. And what do we see now? We see people slaughtered every day as part, civilians slaughtered every day.
The reason you can get to those numbers is also the reason I would say that we have progress. It's science and technology. You just couldn't kill that many people before.
That's true.
The intentions were there. A number of the conquerors of the Middle East and India would make pyramids of skulls.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when you come to the 20th century, you have the capacity to do murder on a scale like that. But you also have something that Dr. Polashek brought to my house one day in the 1940s, penicillin. You think about it. From all of time up to about the 1940s, the simplest kind of infections killed people. There was no way to control it. And then somebody noticed on a petri glass or whatever day you notice things on, there's some kind of mold that's kind of interesting, and they jiggle it around, and suddenly...
Alexander Fleming.
Yes, Alexander Fleming. And Dr. Polashek is the one who administered to me, and I got over something that would have killed me only 50 years before.
It was mold from a slice of bread, as I remember.
Exactly. Originally. Yeah, exactly. So that's the great paradox of the 20th century. The same thing that gives us power to make life better also gives madmen power to make life infinitely worse. Incidentally, if any of the viewers, if any of the listeners have a solution to this, please call immediately on...
312-591-7200, yes. A solution to war, to the eternal scourge of war.
Yeah.
312-591-7200.
How do we celebrate, separate the penicillin from the mass killings?
Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to ancient history or to medieval history. You've worked in that realm as well, and see how it helps to illuminate the present moment. May even bring us back to some historical articles about Chicago, all to follow after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest is a dear old friend, Ron Grossman. That is indeed Grossman of the Tribune, the leading features writer for the paper, as he has been for many years, and at the same time a trained historian who earlier in his career taught history in University of Nebraska, Lake Forest College. What was in between those two?
Michigan State.
Michigan State.
At and St. Olaf College up in Northfield, Minnesota.
Great institutions.
Wonderful college. Wonderful place.
You know, our mutual friend Martin Marty is on the board of St. Olaf.
Is he really?
He's had a long association with them, just as one of their board.
Yeah, I enjoyed my time there terrifically.
Yeah.
Terrifically.
So let us come back to the areas of history in which you worked. You did a good deal of work on the Crusades, actually.
Yes, I did.
And there's yet another war or series of wars. What do we learn from... Well, let's first go directly to the Crusades. Do we find a person who somehow is responsible for getting it started? Is it Peter the Hermit or who exactly?
We know how it happened. The emperor of Constantinople was getting hard-pressed by a Turkish group. And so he sent a letter to the Pope saying, if you could get me some mercenaries, it would be nice.
The Pope, this is in what century?
The 11th century.
11th.
The Pope at the time was having his troubles with the Emperor of Germany. And what was that wonderful movie, The Dog That Wagged the Tail or something like that, about how a war occurs?
Yeah, I do remember.
And he was sort of pinned into that box. And so he needed a popular cause to make himself a little more immune to the German emperor, not to be confused with the Byzantine emperor. So while he was passing through southern France at a city called... my mind is blanking now. It'll come back to me. But he preached a call for people to go to the east. But he slid it by and said, we're not doing this for the emperor there. In fact, we're not quite sure if he's a regular Christian or not. We're doing this to recapture the soil upon which Christ stood. And they say that, the witnesses say, that it was received with such cheering that all the next day the Pope had to cut out little crosses to put on the knights who signed up. That was in 1096. The following year, the knights set off. But before they did, or sort of it, along with it, a fellow by the name of Peter the Hermit went around and said, let's democratize this movement. He didn't say it exactly like that. And he preached it to peasants. And it was a moment of tremendous religiosity. And so we're told tens of thousands, perhaps as many as 100,000 peasants, just left their plots of land and went off to the east. They had no idea where they were going. It was sort of like...
Well, they're going to Jerusalem.
Yes, but they didn't have a map.
Yeah.
And they'd never been 4 miles from home.
Sure.
It was sort of like the Negro spiritual about going to Canada. Follow the drinking gourd.
Yeah.
That is, look for the North Star. All they knew that it was somewhere in the east. And so this ragtag army set off there, and very few of them survived. You know, they were armed, first of all, in the medieval order of things, peasants were supposed not to have offensive weapons. So now they're going with sticks and staves against people that had bows and arrows and things like that. So they, a lot of them were slaughtered.
And this is the First Crusade, the first of a number.
Yes, and this is the subsection of it called the Peasants' Crusade.
How far do the either the knights or the peasants get?
The peasants got as far as Anatolia, modern Turkey, and some of them straggled all the way down there, but most of them didn't survive. The knights set off mainly provincial rulers, for example, one of the Normans, etc. The French Normans and also the Normans who were down in Sicily. And we have a wonderful description of them because the emperor's daughter, wrote a book called, she wrote a book about her father called the Alexia, which is one of the first real descriptive stories that we have of medieval knights.
They get to Jerusalem, but they don't really last, do they?
Oh, yes. But let's get her into the story.
All right.
And it's called the Alexia. That is the story of my father, the emperor. And she describes these wild-looking men from the West, because Byzantium was the center of a surviving ancient civilization. And they're coming from a place where salt and pepper were barely used. But it's like in those Hollywood movies where the brute is also attractive to the woman. Mm-hmm. You can just hear, wow, these guys are a hunk. They and the emperor had a falling out when he belatedly realized they weren't there to do his bidding. They were there to do either the Pope's or their own. In 1099, they took Jerusalem. And there was a terrible massacre after that. They slaughtered the inhabitants, Muslim and Jews, almost to a person.
There's some account where they talk about wading in blood.
Yes. And then they set up a series of kingdoms. One, the Kingdom of Jerusalem, and then to the north of there, one called the Kingdom of Edessa in roughly what would now be Armenia, as I recall. Now, remember that the Pope had sent this off in his name. And as a curious echo of that, the papacy has always felt that the disposition of Jerusalem in the modern world ought to be in his hand, which is why up until the last but one pope, the papacy didn't recognize the state of Israel.
So is this where they established the Crusader kingdom, which lasts for about 100 years?
Yes.
For the First Crusade. I thought it wasn't really established till the Second or Third.
No. They took it in the first one.
Then why were there some five or six other crusades following thereupon?
Because this was a tiny outpost of a few Western knights against a sea of Muslims, Turks, and Arab. And so those who were there kept sending back messages saying, hey, we need some reinforcements. And periodically, reinforcements came out in the form of organized crusades, the second and third. And then some people came out and stayed in this curious thing called the Knights Templar and the Knights Hospitaller, who were knights by day and monks by night. They took vows. They were a member of an order, but they fought. But the numbers were always against them.
And they're up against Muslim forces. Ultimately, the conqueror who pushes them out is Salah ad-Din.
Yes.
Or Saladin.
Saladin, yes. Yeah. He pushes them out of Jerusalem. The knights come back again, and they sort of negotiate a kind of, okay, we won't fight you for control of it anymore if Christian pilgrims can come out there. The Crusades themselves keep on going to the very end of the Middle Ages.
There's something along the line there, but that is called the Children's Crusade. What is that?
Again, there's a fellow that goes through Western Europe, like the Pied Piper of Hamelin,
yes.
And says that what the adults couldn't do, children will do. And they follow him, and then they drop out of the record. Presumably, he must have sold them all into slavery.
In Turkey, probably.
Yeah. And then the Italians got into the act. Just at this time, the northern Italian cities were becoming great seafarers. And so they were the line of supply back. 1204, there's a crusade that goes to Genoa. And Venice or Genoa? My mind is slipping. They go to one of the Italian cities, Venice, actually, and say, okay, let's go. And the Venetians say, okay, we got to see some cash. And they say, oh, we're kind of a little stuck here. So the Venetians cook a deal. We'll give you a line of credit, but before we drop you in the Holy Land, let's go to Constantinople and knock that thing off.
Yeah.
So they went there and they conquered the Byzantine Empire and made a Western Empire for a while.
That beep you heard is a signal.
We have to catch up on contemporary
history.
Well,
we're going to come back to it, because I'm very interested in, if we agree with Thucydides that history should be a possession for all time, that it should pose or point lessons that are applicable later on. I wonder what lessons can be properly derived from the Crusades. That's the question to be addressed right after the update on the evening's news from David Jen.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Ron Grossman. Now, let's see, where were we? I was looking for the historical meaning or the historical
lesson. The moral of the story.
That one might derive from the history of the Crusades. All wars ought to teach something.
Yes, but first...
Basically, they ought to teach you how to avoid war, if
possible. Yes, but before I make an extrapolation, I have to tell you what my personal batting average is.
Yeah.
When the first President Bush went to war, or we under him went to war in Iraq, remember that the Iraqis had taken Kuwait?
Of course, yes.
On the eve of it, I wrote a very long piece called, I believe, Seven Lessons from Middle Eastern History. And I took seven things and talked about them. And the conclusion was, we will be bogged down there in something that will make trench warfare in the First World War seem like a church picnic.
Mm.
As you might remember, it was over real quick. It was like one of Joe Lewis's fights. And when I published that, it went all around the country. And I got all these letters saying, you are brilliant. For once, we know what to anticipate and all that. And I thought, oh, my goodness, now that the war is over, they're going to want their money back. Nobody complained, not one person. So because you know the past doesn't mean that you're going to add up the dominoes correctly this time.
Later on, we got involved in trench warfare in Iraq the second time around and in Afghanistan, which finally we are beating a retreat, calling it something else, but basically it's a retreat. And probably, and there's great danger that both of those nations will revert back to essentially Islamist extremist rule.
You know why Afghanistan is there? Because nobody's ever been able to conquer it.
Yeah. Just about everybody has tried.
Yes, and failed.
The Russians did twice.
Right.
The British did.
Yeah.
We did.
In the 19th century, Britain and Russia are expanding, and that's sort of like the end piece of the checkerboard.
Yeah.
It was something called, euphemistically, I suppose, the Great Game, and nobody ever won.
One of my favorite moments for a quotation goes back to modern time when Paul VI was the Pope in Rome. And he comes to the UN to give a speech. And it's a papal kind of speech. It's instructing the world how to get things right and do things better. And it's all focused on war. This is still during the period of the Cold War. The Soviet Union has not yet collapsed. And he gives a speech in French. And I remember the thrilling last moment, he says, jamais la guerre, jamais plus la guerre. Those are the last words. Never war. Never again.
War.
War.
Yes.
And since then, we've probably killed a few million in various wars.
Yes. Somewhere in the Bible it says, everywhere men call for peace and everywhere it doesn't happen.
Yes.
Yeah. It is interesting that humanity doesn't give up on that. If you look at greetings, most of them say, peace be unto you, shalom aleichem, salam aleichem. The idea is that would that there would be peace. I mean, the historic record doesn't support
it. It's shalom aleichem or salam aleichem, and then it's reversed. Aleichem salam.
Right.
Peace be unto you and peace be unto you as well.
Coming back to the Romans, they had the longest running period of peace from the last of the last days of the Republic down through at least the middle of the 3rd century, and it was called the Pax Romana, the Great Roman Peace. Now, it only applied to people inside their empire, but it was a time of tremendous tranquility and economic development.
Well, they're still battling on the borders, though, putting down tribes trying to break in.
Yes. One of the philosophers, Marcus Aurelius, wrote his stuff at night after pushing back
the Germans.
The Germans by day. But for the people in the interior, you could travel from what's now Great Britain to Egypt and to what's now Israel and the Palestinian territories in relative safety.
So here's the challenge for you.
Yes.
Just the other night, we did a program on modern Iran.
Yes.
And which is a turbulent place, to say the least. And the Middle East remains a very turbulent setting, not only because Iran is a great threat, particularly if it goes forward and gets nuclear weaponry, but also because of the seemingly eternal struggle and face-off between the Palestinians and Israel. And we've had the so-called Arab Spring, which may be turning into Arab winter, with Islamist extremists coming to power in Egypt, and surely they have done the same in Libya, and who knows what Syria will ultimately turn out to be. And war is in the air. And indeed, our president only today spoke to AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, and suggested, yes, maybe if we have to, we, U.S., the United States, will go to war, but not now. That is, to try to suppress the Iranians if they don't finally fully renounce the ambition to develop nuclear weapons. We have the meeting between Netanyahu and the president tomorrow, in which this will be under very close discussion. And the Israelis
would like to be a pickle on the relish trade at that little meeting.
But the Israelis, we know, have reserved the right to take independent action if necessary. And many of them, I read on the air just the other night, or at least I made reference to an op-ed in the New York Times by a former head of military intelligence in Israel, who says, we've got to do it, and if we don't do it sooner, you, the United States, will have to do it later. We reach a point where we won't be able to do it because of all the comparatively invulnerable stuff the Iranians will build. We can't do the real bunker-busting kind of job that you can do with your fuller military equipment. So you better let us do it now if necessary, or else you're going to have to do it later, said he. That war is in the air.
I
review all of this to ask you, so what, oh seer, oh wise man, oh historian, so what do we draw from history to somehow sort this out and maybe even find a solution?
I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago, and it's not a nice lesson.
Mm-hmm.
What occurred to me is that the smell now is what Europe went through in the countdown to World War One. It begins with...
This reminds you of the lead into World War One, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
Why?
Because in the late spring of 1914, the heir apparent to the throne of Austria is touring his realms, and a Serbian nationalist killed him. Yeah.
In Sarajevo.
In Sarajevo, yes. The Austrians then demand that Serbia do this and that and this and that. The Serbians are not unwilling, but they go to their big power backer, which is Russia. The Austrians don't back down, but, you know, they're kind of a tottering old state, so they go to their backer, Germany. the Russians have a treaty with France, and they say, you know, if it happens, you got to help us because we got a treaty. Fine. The French had just finally made up, at least temporarily, with the British. You know, they have disputes about, you know, whose food is more tasty and all of this. And so the British are aligned there. And each side pushes it a little further and a little further. And in the middle of all of this, the Germans got a tip that the French are really not that anxious to get involved. So they could be, with suitable reassurances, allowed to sit it out and say to the Russians, oh, you know, we forgot that treaty or we lost the paper or something like that. But the German general said, no, we can't do that. And the statesman said, how come? They said, well, it's something called the Schlieffen Plan. The Germans had been fearful of having war on two fronts if Germany had to face France and Russia. So they drew up a plan based on the idea that it's better to knock off one and then the other, and that Russia, being relatively backward, if war comes, it would take them a while to get their armies in the field. So the first thing we want to do is send all of our army, virtually all of our army, to France, knock them out, then put them on railroads. Remember, this is the beginning of the age of railroads, and send them all to the Russian front. And then the statesman said, yeah, but we can avoid war with France. They said, we can't do it. The railroad schedules have been drawn up. The units are notified. The only way to go to Moscow is through Paris. And, in fact, that's what happens.
It's also rather parallel to what happened in the Second World War.
Yes, exactly. And if you look at what's happening there now, just as chess pieces on a thing, the Iranians say, no, we won't back down. The Israelis say, we will not live under the threat of nuclear power, Iran. The Americans and Europeans belatedly put in economic sanctions. I stress the belatedly. And then Iran says, okay, then we're going to close the Straits of Hormuz. And the U.S. says, we're not going to tolerate that, so we sent our ships there. Now you got everybody poised, just like Serbia, Russia, France, etc. All you need is one mistake, and the thing happens.
It's that situation that Dean Rusk, who was once our Secretary of State, described as, we're standing eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other guy just blinked.
Yes, exactly.
You hope the other guy is
going to blink. Yeah, you hope it's the other guy, or that you don't get something in your eye and it happens again. It to me, it's frightening, like the run-up to World War I.
Which, if that happened, and if we went against Iran, we would do it with nuclear, with air assault, obviously.
One would hope.
But that might have further repercussions, and Iran would respond. They don't need nuclear weapons to try to knock off Israel. They've got an air force, they've got heavy bombers, and they can do a major assault that way. Or they could throw missiles with conventional TNT warheads rather than nuclear. But
you know, the interesting thing about the Israeli personality is that living with that threat for as long as they have, they carry it remarkably lightly on their shoulders. Virtually every building in Israel has a bomb shelter because the assumption is at some point we're going to have to take refuge from things falling on our head.
When we had the first Iraq war, when...
The one I called wrong, yes.
Yeah, Bush Sr.
Yes.
Sent the troops in to rescue and restore Kuwait. You remember that that the Iraqis, Saddam Hussein, started bombing Israel.
Yes.
They threw missiles against Israel.
Right.
And killed a few people. And we had the occasion on this program to call, of all people, Abba Iban.
And really?
We got him. He was in he was in a bomb shelter, but somehow was able to talk on a telephone. and give us some sense of what was happening there that very night in Jerusalem.
That's fabulous. I had tea with him one time years ago, and
he was on the program a few times. We had some access to him.
I had tea with him in Herzliya, where he lived, and I introduced myself. I was there as a guest of somebody, and said, "I bring you thanks from all the Jewish boys of my generation who grew up to be more than we probably should, because our mothers would watch you at the UN on the television and say, can't you speak a nice English like him?"
Yes. We are late for some commercials, but it is time now to invite telephone calls. What have we stirred up? I'd like to know from our listeners, what are your thoughts about what we've been saying? For that matter, of course, any questions you've got are more than welcome. Questions about the relevance of history to the present situation, however you define the present situation, including the present situation in the politics of the United States, of which we've said nothing tonight, but that is much in the air as well. At any rate, anything you want to ask or anything you want to tell or anything you want to recall, please get in there quickly. 312-591-7200 is, of course, the phone number. 312-591-7200. And for overseas listeners or others listening on the Internet at some greater distance, your best way in is via email, and the email address, extension 720 at wgnradio.com. So get in there with question or comment and do it instantly if you possibly can, so we can get to you directly after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
So here's the situation. Ron Grossman is with me, as he has so often been. And this is a different edition of the Grossman Gazette, as we used to call it. But we'll be going directly now to the phones. It's been rather a loose conversation, basically focused on history and the historical research and writing that Ron did in his earlier career. But that has continued to inform his work as one of the leading journalists of the town. 312-591-7200, and let's go to the first caller, that one being Bob, who joins us at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Yes, sir. Good evening. The question I'd like to pose is, I don't believe you touched on the situation in Syria, although you were discussing current Mideast politics. My personal perspective is that Iran is losing its influence as it's losing Syria, and when Syria finally falls, I think that's the precursor to when Iran falls itself again through internal problems such as the Arab Spring. I'd like to hear your opinion, gentlemen.
I'd like to hear more of that. How did the dominoes tumble from Syria back to Iran? Is it a loss of face or something like that?
My understanding is that the Iranians have the largest amount of influence on Syria. They are the main backers of Syria. And again, similar to your domino theory in World War One, I see them as really losing Iran, because if Syria can fall, any of the dictators can fall.
Well, they're pretty tough guys in Syria, rather in Iran. They're tough guys in Syria as well. Assad is killing thousands of his own citizens. But we talked about this recently. I've talked with experts who know a great deal about Iran and are the Iranian themselves. And this bunch run by the Ayatollah Khamenei, not Khomeini, but Khamenei, who is the supreme leader, they do not hesitate at all to kill people, to imprison them, and for that matter, to suppress any kind of rebellion, which they did in 2009. They killed people on the streets of Tehran. They don't fall if the Assad regime falls. They have lost a partner, in a way, a junior partner, in terms of comparative strength. I think the crucial group there is Hezbollah, which is located in Lebanon and dependent upon Syria, but ultimately funded by Iran. Hezbollah, a great threat to Israel on the northern border, might have difficulty in its further anti-Israeli undertakings.
You know, if you want to follow that domino theory, what occurs to me is that Syria's influence in Lebanon is less than it used to be. They had troops there and, in fact, essentially occupied about a third of the country. Then they were forced out of that. So you could see a direction. I love historical maps where you see big arrows going through time. You could see the influence or the power going back towards its center. It's not a bad theory. Let's make one thing very clear. What's happening now in Syria is a disgrace to everybody.
To Western countries.
The fact that our criticism has been muted, our aid, our moral counsel, everything.
But is there a Nicaraguan parallel? Let me thank the caller. That will surprise you. But what I mean by that, you remember way back a long time ago, they spoke of Somoza, the dictator of Nicaragua. And I think it was Roosevelt who was quoted as saying, he's a bastard, but he's our bastard.
He's our bastard, yes.
And is Assad a bastard, but has he been essentially our bastard? When the rebellion succeeds, if it does, even with aid by us, might it not turn very quickly into a victory for the Muslim Brotherhood or similar organizations? Essentially, the Salafi brand of Muslim extremism, which is super anti-Israeli and is super anti-Western.
Now that you mentioned it, if you look back to when he succeeded his father, he was the hope of the West. He's Western educated.
That nice ophthalmologist brought back from London.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we were over invested in him the one way and are probably a little reluctant to let go of that sense of stability. Nonetheless, for people on the ground, it's just a horrendous tragedy. You know, any time civilians are being bombarded, be they Israelis, Palestinians, or Syrians, it is just something the world should not tolerate.
We are about to pause for a quick round of commercials and then back to the phones. There are people online waiting, but I see a few spaces also available on the board. Get in there with any question or comment you've got. I think we've stirred people up with talk about the Middle East and about Iran, but any question you want to raise or any comment you want to or thought you want to offer with regard to all the other areas of history that we've been traversing, or for that matter, the history of more or less modern Chicago. You've done some wonderful pieces on that recently. We might evoke one or two more before we finish tonight. Right now we go to the WGN newsroom and David Jones.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And to our friends waiting online, please stay there. We'll be with you in about 5 minutes. But something came up in our chat during the last few minutes, which interests me a good deal. Back to the history of Chicago, and you got a particular incident which has a model both going forward and probably could find historical models going back. At any rate, it's chutzpah. Pushed by the civic fathers.
Yes, and first let me tell the one antecedent that comes to mind.
Yeah.
You know, in Rome, as the Republic is falling, they formed the so-called First Triumvirate.
Uh-huh.
The big partner was Caesar, and he's a general, and the second partner was Crassus, and he was a wealthy man. And the way he got wealthy is they didn't have a municipal fire department in Rome, so he set up one of his own. If your building got on fire, he would bring his pumpers out there, or whatever they had, and said, I'll buy this building, and I'll give you X dollars. And the person would say, ridiculous, that's way below market price. And he'd let it burn down a story, and then he'd offer less. And finally, when the guy said, okay, he'd hand them the money and put out the fire. Chicago inherited, in some kind of zigzag line, that kind of way of doing business. You know, we had a perennial problem in the early years of the city because we used Lake Michigan as our water supply, and it also drained the Chicago River, which was our sewage. So the sewage would go into the water, into the lake. It'd be pumped back into the taps, and we had typhoid epidemics. So they decided to reverse the river. You know, sometimes Hashem doesn't get it right, so we'll help them out. And instead of having a river run into a lake, we'll send the river back the other way.
And the other way means that it goes downriver to where?
To the Mississippi.
Yeah, but what cities are the way?
Well, St. Louis, which was not exactly happy about this proposal, and thought, well, first of all, the sewage will kill us, and it will certainly kill our beer sales, because it was already famous as that. Yeah. So they were trying to get an injunction from a federal court to stop it. Fortunately for us, courts work slowly, and, you know, jurisdiction and this and that. So as the thing was set to go and the St. Louisans were going to court, we sent out, that is, the mayor sent out a crew to take the last land barrier. You know, you dig a canal and then there's a last piece of earth, to take it out and put a wooden sluice gate in there, whatever a wooden sluice gate is, and then to announce with a kind of a Chicago wink, you know, if that thing ever lets go, we'll never be able to stop the water. And miracle of miracles, on January 1st of 1900, the water seeped through that barrier, went down the river, and St. Louis had to live with the consequences.
Well, that's why I call it chutzpah. Yeah. You do it while you can, even if it's illegal. And once it's a reality, once it's a fait accompli, nobody could do anything about it.
Well, in a way, it wasn't illegal because they hadn't got served with the papers yet. The thing kicked around in court for years after that. It finally got to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote a decision that said, you know, basically you can't put the water back. But it seems a pity to have the fate of great rivers settled by squabbles between cities.
Why does this somehow remind me of A Dark Night at Miggs Field
the second Mayor Daley decided enough with this taking off of airplanes. They're close to where I live. The noise is intolerable. So he just sent out a bulldozer and and had the runways taken out. That was chutzpah to the second degree, because the thing that they either hadn't calculated or didn't even care was there were planes on the ground. Once you take the runways out, what do you do? Make those into a living museum or something like that? They had to figure out, as I recall, a way to use the taxi strips as impromptu runways to get the last of the airplanes out of there.
We go back to the phones, 312-591-7200. If you've been trying to reach us and hitting a busy signal, try again right now because we've got a few lines available again. And next up is Kathy. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. All the talk we hear right now about the Middle East is about a conventional or nuclear war. Wouldn't it be more effective right now for the Israelis and the United States, or the Israelis by themselves, to launch a cyber war? I mean, I'm not trying to be facetious at all.
Oh, they've done some of that already.
Well, what I was going to say was you hear about 18- and 20-year-olds hacking into corporate and government computers all the time. Yes, I understand they have done some of it, but wouldn't that be the most effective thing right now is to really concentrate on that?
Well, as I understand it, you checked me on this, Ron. They did, using cyber war, one might call it, they did get a virus in which invalidated some of the equipment that was doing the refining of the uranium.
Somehow it affected the performance of the centrifuges that separate the various kinds of uranium, and that did set it back. The other thing which the Israelis, though they would never quite admit to it, have been doing is taking out, that is with extreme prejudice, scientists who work on the atomic facilities there.
Killing them on the streets of Tehran.
And I think one or two in Europe, perhaps. But, you know, it's a race in time. And the time it takes a missile to go from Iran to Israel is minutes, right? They live under a threat that it's almost impossible for us to imagine. But, yes, you know, anything short of war or war by another means is preferable to the alternative.
Yeah.
Thank you, ma'am, for the call.
Interesting contribution.
Thank you.
Indeed. And let's go to another caller. 312-591-7200. And here is Jim who joins us. Good evening, sir.
Hi. Good evening. Interesting show as always. Along the same lines, do we have the technology to just knock off their power for a week and show them that we really have an upper hand over them?
You mean shut down the electric grid or something?
Yeah, just shut down the electric grid no bombs, no nothing. Just say, hey, we can do a little bit more than you think we can.
That's a brilliant idea. We've done that accidentally in the United States, where electric grid suddenly malfunctioned or something like that. That's a brilliant idea.
And just because I'm being extra proud, but I think we have a lot of things that we don't know about that we could just show off if we had to in a crisis.
I'd go for that.
And we thank you, sir, for the call.
Before we go to the next one, I wanted to have a footnote about Crassus. He of the making himself wealthy with the private fire department.
Yeah, in Rome.
He didn't have military experience like Caesar, and thought, well, gee, now that I've got the money and he's this big hero, I better do the same thing. So he went off to fight the Parthians in roughly Iran and got his lunch handed to him. He was better at being a real estate dealer with a sharp practice than leading troops in battle, and he was killed and the legions were destroyed. I guess that's, you know, ground wars in the Middle East often come to not a good end.
Here's an interesting email from one of our listeners. She says, "You've forgotten one thing, Mr. Laszlo. Here in Casablanca, life is cheap." That's a quotation from the film Casablanca. Laszlo is the underground hero from Europe.
French resistance, yes.
Yeah, and he's married to Ingrid Bergman.
Yes. That's my idea of being a resistance fighter.
So you've forgotten one thing, Mr. Laszlo. Here in Casablanca, life is cheap, paren, or words to that effect. And that's that quotation. Then she goes on to say, I'm afraid that this century is shaping up to be bloodier and more evil than the last one was. Life, in other words, remains very cheap. It's true.
Yeah, it is possible, but if you look at the record of the last century, that's a heck of a record to overcome. We do have a United Nations, and for all its faults and all its bickering, it does from time to time slow things down a bit. And that's something that Europeans started trying to do right after the Napoleonic Wars, have some kind of debating society where you can take it away from the generals, at least for a moment.
We're on serious territory now, you know, really. War we've always had with us. And you can say, well, we'll always have it with us. We maybe can contain it or limit it. The UN might have some functionality along those lines. But what really bugged us during the long run of the Cold War with the Soviet Union was that we now had these weapons which could destroy total civilizations and might even destroy the ecology of the planet itself. Nuclear winter, the scenario that Carl Sagan and others elaborated upon, depending upon how much nuclear assault would take place, could even all happen on one Sunday afternoon. And as nuclear weapons are proliferating, if Iran is allowed to go forward to fabricate some nuclear warheads, then most of the other nations of the Middle East,
it is
conjectured, will do the same thing. Saudi Arabia will certainly do it when all sorts of nations, including ultimately Guatemala or what have you, have mounted nuclear weapons. You just can't imagine that the structure of deterrence which held us in check during the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, you can't imagine that deterrence will still obtain and still be trustworthy.
Especially as states fail.
Yes.
Is there a term? Is that a verb? Because we talk about failed states. But as it happens, those weapons fall into the hands of people that are not rational characters.
There is even now some concern as to whether all of the Soviet warheads have been accounted for.
Well, on that enlightening thought,
We'll pause for some commercials.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My old buddy Ron Grossman has been our guest and remains our guest for the next 13 minutes. This has been the most unusual session for us.
It's been a conversation, which is what radio ought to be about.
It really should. It really should. But like all good conversation, it wanders a bit. You don't know where it's going to go.
You know, when the first of the tape recorders came out, We had a kind of salon in a building we lived in Hyde Park. It, generally at 9 o'clock in the evening, we'd gather in one or another apartment and have a little light refreshment and all of that. And somebody took a tape recorder and put it under the couch and then played it back afterwards. And it's amazing how human conversation zigzags. It doesn't follow a straight line.
You know, we already captured that. The English playwright Pinter. Harold Pinter.
Yes.
You wonder if maybe he put microphones under subconscious in London.
Or maybe he lived at 6106 South Ellis, which was the building that we lived in.
6106.
South Ellis.
That's across the Midway.
Yes, it was. It was across the Midway, and it was known either as the ghetto, because a lot of students were Jewish, or the commune, because it was kind of like the left wing of the operation.
Let's go back to the phones, 312-591-7200. Rudy is our next caller. Good evening.
Hello, Dr. Rosenberg. How are you?
Just fine, sir. Thank you.
How many countries are there in the world? Would you happen to know that?
I bet you do know it.
I don't know it.
My guess is 131. I think I just saw that someplace.
All right. How many are members of the United Nations?
I think that's what we're counting, is members of the United Nations.
Well, the thing is, if we don't get everyone to go along about this war problem that we've been having for hundreds of years, somewhere, somehow, someday, somebody's going to set off some nuclear bombs, and then it's going to be the end. It's going to be the start of the end. So what I think we as Americans should do is push the United Nations and try to get everybody in it and interested and outlaw war. Because if we don't, we are going to run into some real big...
We've just run into some real big...
Glitch
or failing of a telephone system. I don't know why or how, but who can disagree with that?
No. In fact, the people who worked on the atomic bomb for the United States immediately lobbied afterwards to have them taken over by the United Nations. Yeah. And I think the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists still has that clock that they move the hand closer to 12 o'clock, closer and further away as they judge the proximity of a terrible...
And they're still there at the University of, on the campus of the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
To another caller on 312-591-7200. And next up is Ed. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm curious with your discussion and knowledge of ancient history, what you think of the many contemporary comparisons with the decline and fall of the Roman Empire with that of the United States. Is that just specious, or are there some actual parallels there?
Well, it's a very valuable question, actually.
It haunts me. It truly haunts me. If you look what happened in Rome, it conquered the whole of the Mediterranean world. And think of the immensity of it, from England into the nearest part of Germany, through the whole of the Balkans, the Middle East, Iraq for a while, Egypt, and across North Africa. That's an enormous piece of territory. And it was held together not just by military power, but by economic weight. Then the Romans and Rome and Italy were exporters. But then that ceased after a while, and people in the other countries, namely in Gaul, developed viniculture. The great products of the ancient world were olives and grapes to make wine. Olives because you have to have some fat in your body, a substance, and you wash with it, etc. Grapes because after a hard day you want to get schnockered. That's the universal of human life. And Rome exported those. But then after a while, the French products got cheaper, and the Romans started importing them and then stopped producing their own. And if you strip away the glorification of globalization, to me that's what's happened to the United States. We taught the world manufacturing. We invented the assembly line. And now go into a big box store and try to find something that's not made in China. Take a look at the deficit every year that we run up, and that's what happened to Rome. It became an economic liability instead of the center of an empire. It literally haunts me day and night.
And not only do you have economic problems from which one might predict decline, you also have cultural disorder, which and a loss of faith in the validity of the system, a loss of central shared values, which also contributes to a kind of a decadence in which ultimately the desire to maintain the system simply disappears.
It worked out in a wondrous way in the ancient world. That same those same provinces, which overtook Italy and Rome economically, mm-hmm. had more of a sense of the necessity for Rome to survive than the people of Rome did.
Uh-huh.
You know, Attila and the Huns from the MGM movies, they sweep across Europe and all of that. And the emperors couldn't do much, but the people of Roman Gaul got together an army and beat them back. And they did it not to declare their independence, which they certainly had the military right to do it, or the military power to do, but because they thought more of the empire than the Romans themselves did.
Do you get a sense that I do get, do you share it, that an American system of values is sort of frayed around the edges, and people have become more consumer-oriented, maybe more selfish, more narcissistic. Narcissistic, if one can use that tired psychiatric phrase, so that we just aren't as committed to keeping this system going, keeping this country going. We are truly not as patriotic as we used to be.
I might say it on another occasion, but before I came in here tonight, I watched the national news of the terrible storm damage across the country.
Yeah, well, people come together at times of crisis.
Exactly, and one of the ways they came together, besides the wondrous thing of people driving down there to help out, was that every time they would cut to another town that's leveled, somebody put up an American flag.
Yeah.
Now, if you think that your house is gone, you're wondering if everybody survived. You're looking for the family dog. You're trying to improvise where you're going to get food from. But you have that feeling that you want to put Old Glory up there. Now, here's the fascinating thing. That's what armies do. When armies are take a position, they put their flag over it as if to say, we will not be beaten.
Yeah.
And in a time of terrible disaster like this, people do the same thing. There's a photo on the front page of the New York Times that shows a fellow putting up a tattered American flag on a pole that's still bending in the wind.
Hmm.
It came from the Cincinnati Inquirer, I think, and I can just see that the photographer must have run three blocks because he saw that, and he said, that's the iconic image, or in the back of his mind, that's my Pulitzer. But it's telling how people still have that feeling of wanting to say that America doesn't get beat.
Our thanks to the caller, and let's work in a last one, that being Tom. You are on the air, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. I was going to say that the sword, the pen is mightier than the sword, and the lessons we've learned from history in Chicago, the great Chicago politicians in 1825 were trying to ratify the treaty with the Indians, and they weren't able to do so, so they stacked the court, so to speak, and they got some sympathetic individuals, one of which was Chief Chichipinque, also known as Chief Robinson, who's buried over here on Lawrence Avenue by the O'Hare Airport. And for a barrel of salt, they were able to ratify the Treaty of Chicago of 1825. And so the solution to the Iranian thing is diplomacy, and we have to get a little regime change in there and try to get some people in there with some common sense and realize that a rising tide lifts all ships and ratify a peace treaty between all nations.
Amen, but I want to hear more about the chief, where he's buried.
Oh, he's buried right there where the Schuessler-Peterson kids were found, on Lawrence and what they now call East River Road. There's a rock out there.
Oh.
And unfortunately, that treaty disintegrated with the War of 1832 and the battle at Stillman's Creek, the first battle which was fought just south of Rockford, and Abraham Lincoln.
The so-called Black Hawk War?
Yeah, that is.
Exactly, yeah. But hopefully diplomacy will be able to get some people some common sense in there. I'm sure they're working the back channels over there in Iran, and we have some regime change and try to get some people in there. Well,
That's a regime that won't yield very easily to
But as my mother used to say, from your mouth to God's ears, may that happen.
And to the CIA.
Yeah, right.
The CIA changed the government of Iran once a long time ago.
Yes.
When they restored the Shah to the throne.
Right, yeah.
But I don't think it's going to be as easy this time.
Yeah.
Well, we're just about out of time. This has been fun.
It certainly really has. Great. It certainly has. And from the response of the listeners, the history is of interest.
Do you ever wish you could get back to the classroom and teach a full course, or have you done that during your newspaper days?
No, and I'll tell you what happens is that every time I go out to do a story on a college campus, I get a wave of nostalgia, and then I find out how brutal the battles have become, and I say it's time to go back
home. And you write some very fine reportorial, cynical pieces about university life.
Thank you.
I've read some of those. In fact, I've even contributed in terms of giving you my opinions for one of those, about a university not too far away from here, a little ways to the south.
Exactly. But more about that on another evening.
We've done it before. We will do that again as well. And with that, we wind down for the evening. Our guest has been Grossman of the Tribune, Ron Grossman, who can be read regularly with his wonderful feature stories. We'll be back again tomorrow night for a full 2-hour program. It begins at